their cameras back on that will be participating today. And just wait one more minute here. There we go. All right. Well, first off, I have some remarks before we begin. Thank you all for participating remotely today. The same rules apply. Even though we're doing this remotely, the same rules that would have applied if we were in the Judicial Center apply to our hearings today. I want to make a comment about the gallery view. There are different ways, on Zoom to view the other participants. If you are in the gallery view, you should be able to see the clock, which is the most important thing for you all, to know how much time is remaining to present your arguments. So just take a moment and make sure you're able to do that. Also, from time to time, there may be interruptions or problems, technical difficulties. We'll do what we can to keep these at a minimum. And I want to assure you that if you have any problems, let us know. We will do what we can to accommodate that and make sure that you have all the time to which you're entitled to present your arguments this morning. And then finally, when you begin speaking, please, I know you typically state your names and the party you represent, but just take a minute to make sure to pronounce your name so that we know how to pronounce your name as well and your client's name. And then also let us know if you or your client have any preferences that we should know about when we're referring to you. And with that, let's call the case, please, Marshall.
Calling case number A230152, Lucas Paul Gilbertson, appellant versus 1-2019 GMC Yukon Denali SUV respondent.
Mr. Kohler, are you prepared to proceed this morning?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Lucas Paul Gilbertson, in this appeal. I prefer he, him, as does Mr. Gilbertson. This appeal starts with the understanding that appellant is in an extremely difficult appellate posture. Not only is the standard of review favorable to respondent, but in this particular case, the district court found all of Mr. Gilbertson's testimony non-credible. That extremely limits the factual basis for arguing this appeal. In addition, there have been significant changes to the forfeiture law since this incident, so it does require switching gears to look at the old law and not the changes that have been made that would have eliminated this appeal under the new law. That being said, there is enough of a basis in this record to conclude that it was erroneous to decide that Mr. Gilbertson had no ownership rights in this vehicle and had knowledge that it was going to be used in a manner contrary to law. The easier of the two arguments is the ownership argument. It's not based on any of Mr. Gilbertson's testimony. It's just the fact that he is indeed the registered owner of the vehicle. He's on the only person on the bill of sale. The vehicle was parked in his garage. And the standard under the statute is, was he legally entitled to control, use, or possess the vehicle? For decades, I've always asked, could this person have stolen the vehicle as a shorthand way of deciding who the owner was? If he had driven that vehicle, could somebody else have called the police and said, my vehicle's been stolen, Mr. Gilbertson took it, he had no right to do it? Under that test, which is my test, not a court test, it fails. I mean, he absolutely had the right to drive that vehicle. He had some ownership. There's a lot of unpublished case law in particular back before joint owners could independently raise the innocent owner defense. And in those situations, they're really keying in on the fact that multiple people actually owned this vehicle. I'm unaware of case law that says the registered owner who has the vehicle at their house has no legal ownership rights whatsoever. So I think in this case, it was an error as a matter of law to completely divest Mr. Gilbertson of any of the ownership rights that are defined in the forfeiture statute, because he did have some rights in the vehicle.
And where counsel, in the order is that finding that he had no ownership interest?
It's prior to the findings. If we look at, it'd be appellant's appendix, page 6, also page 6 of the order. The paragraph in the middle of the page, the court finds and concludes the greater weight of the evidence indicates that either Ms. Rivard was the sole owner, which is effectively saying Mr. Gilbertson had no rights to the vehicle whatsoever, or that they were joint owners. And as we discussed in the briefs, the court mistakenly thought that joint owners could not bring innocent owner claims when the statute was specifically amended to allow for that. And so it's that finding doesn't defeat the innocent owner claim. And I do believe it was an error as a matter of law to say on this record that Mr. Gilbertson had no ownership rights in this vehicle whatsoever, for the reasons stated. The far more difficult hurdle is the second element of the innocent owner defense, whether he had actual or constructive knowledge that the vehicle would be operated in a manner contrary to law. I do think the record is clear that he didn't have actual notice that she was going to drive. He wasn't, even if we're discrediting all of his testimony, he didn't.
Mr. Kohler, could I just interrupt you before you get into the facts on that issue? I'm wondering, is there any case law that kind of defines or fleshes out the meaning of that paragraph about actual or constructive knowledge that the vehicle would be used in or operated in any manner contrary to law?
There's a fair amount of unpublished case law. I think the Hawkinson unpublished decision would be the closest one to what I would be arguing for this case, and I'll get into that in a little bit. But it really does seem to be very, very fact-specific, and a lot of the inferences don't necessarily become applicable to other cases.
Can we tease out of the case law any sort of rule or standard or, you know, line drawing about what level of probability or certainty is required for that finding? In other words, there could be a situation, I own a car that my teenager drives, and on any given day, I don't think he's violating the law, but one never knows. There's always a probability that he might. The facts of this case, Ms. Rivard, it seems, has a propensity to violate the law. And so it seems there was some substantial probability. I'm just wondering, you know, how we determine whether that particular language in the statute is satisfied. Whether it seems like we have to have a legal standard in mind before we evaluate the evidence. I'm not sure if you might agree or disagree with that, but I'm explaining a little bit further the nature of my question.
And I think I understand the question, and that's why this is such a difficult argument to make on the appellate level, where the district court does have wide discretion to draw those inferences on whether there was constructive knowledge. And again, the case law is kind of all over the map. I couldn't find published case law clearly on point. We know that, generally speaking, constructive knowledge is something was going on long enough where you're presumed to have notice, which would go to the court's statements about, somebody's prior record. But the legislature actually took that into account. And this was one argument I also couldn't find in the applicable case law. I mean, the legislature said you can presume constructive knowledge under certain circumstances. Family or household member with multiple prior offenses. That's what happened here, is we're presuming, because of her priors, that Mr. Gilbertson knew she was going to drive in a manner contrary to law. But there is no presumption. The legislature specifically gave the circumstances where we could make that presumption. It wasn't one prior. It wasn't two prior convictions. It was three. And so Ms. Rivard isn't in a position to have, or Mr. Gilbertson rather, isn't presumed to know she was going to drive it contrary to law. So your honor,
did Ms. Rivard have driving privileges?
She did not. She was driving.
So if she drove, it's not a question of whether she was going to do something. The moment she would drive, she would be driving unlawfully, would she not, without driving privileges? Is that accurate or not?
Not necessarily, for a couple different reasons. One would be she was, and this court can take judicial notice of the fact that she was eligible to go on ignition interlock.
But she was not on it.
She was not on it.
Okay. So on that day or that time period, she was not on it. Okay.
So that day she was eligible to get on it, but she was not. The other requirement would be necessity. She could have driven the vehicle in case of an emergency, you know, a fire in the home. There is a use case where she could use the vehicle in a manner that was not contrary to law. And so it's limited. It's very limited because she was revoked at the time, but it's there. And that's the crux of this argument. If the court listens to that and says, nope, I'm not buying it, I mean, then we don't prevail. But we can't just impute this knowledge because of her priors or because of her driver's status that she was going to drive in a manner contrary to law. There's no presumption in the statute to that effect. He didn't know she was going to drive, even though she had driven previously on a revoked license.
Now, I think you argued that the district court inappropriately applied that presumption, but I had difficulty finding the application of the presumption in the district court's order. And then in the responsive brief, the respondent argues that there was no reliance on that presumption. I don't believe you filed a reply brief. So I'm just kind of wondering if you have a rebuttal argument to that responsive argument.
Yeah, I mean, if respondent is conceding that Ms. Rivard's prior record has no bearing on this, then I fully agree. Because there was a lot of discussion in the findings of fact regarding her prior record, which I'm arguing is only relevant if you're going to apply the presumption of constructive knowledge, which again,
why isn't it just relevant to deciding whether there's constructive knowledge? I don't know that there's a concession that no prior facts are relevant to determining it. I think there was an argument that there was not an application of a presumption by the district court.
And that's my argument here, is that unless you reach the level of being able to take advantage of that presumption, you can't use that to prove constructive knowledge.
Why not?
Because the legislature set it out that way. They could have just said there could be no presumption whatsoever. Because that's what we're doing here, is we're presuming constructive knowledge based on priors.
Mr. Kohler, if I could ask a somewhat related question. In terms of the standard of proof, I think both parties agree if this is a clear and convincing standard of proof. Is that right?
Under the old statute, yes, it was clear and convincing.
Well, that's the one we're supposed to apply, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So under the applicable statute, the standard of proof is clear and convincing. And then the burden of proof, as I understand it, is on Mr. Gilbertson.
Correct.
Okay. So there may not be a presumption because of the three priors, but nevertheless, it's Mr. Gilbertson's burden to show by clear and convincing evidence that he did not have constructive knowledge.
Correct.
Okay.
And in that context, because we can't credit any of his testimony, that we're not even crediting the testimony that says he was out of town for several months at the time of this incident, but it's undisputed that he was not there. And the way I've seen in the district courts this provision of the statute interpreted, it was that if you could presume the knowledge because the person was a family or household member with the X amount of priors, then you weren't going to be able to take advantage of the innocent owner claim. But it was very easy to prove lack of actual constructive knowledge for an individual that wasn't present at the time of the incident, even by clear and convincing evidence. Somebody that's in another state, or just at least not even present, is.
I think there are lots of facts that we could imagine that could establish that could meet this heightened standard of proof that the party. In your shoes would be able to present, you know, they could have locked the keys or they could have taken some steps or, you know, whatever, but that we don't have those facts here, even if you do credit the testimony, which we can't do, right? I mean, there are facts we can imagine. It's not an impossible standard.
No. And that question actually brings up probably the final point I'll be able to make in my case in chief, is the fact that the court also spent time rebutting the affirmative defense that he prevented or denied Ms. Rivard from using this vehicle, where there's no allegation that that was actually the case. We're certainly not arguing that on appeal. But again, there seems to be the tendency to hold that against him. The fact that the presumption doesn't apply is being held against Mr. Gilbertson. The fact that he didn't prevent use being held against him, when in reality, the statute reads in a way where you could take advantage of that provision. But there's not a presumption that if you didn't hide the keys, then you constructively or actually knew the vehicle was going to be operated contrary to law. And again, that's the, I'm sorry.
I had it. If you're done with that subject, I have a question. Kind of going back, are you arguing that if the presumption based on three priors is not triggered, that there then is also sort of a contrary presumption, either rebuttable or conclusive, that the constructive knowledge cannot be established?
Not quite as strict as that formulation, but some of the unpublished cases, the court goes into the fact that, you know, this person wasn't presumed to have constructive knowledge because the driver didn't have enough priors. So why did the district court presume they had constructive knowledge? Because they had less than the requisite amount of priors. And I see my time has expired, and I'll maybe formulate a better answer for rebuttal.
You just said, why did the district court presume? My understanding is the district court did not presume. It simply found that he had the constructive knowledge, even though there were fewer than three of those incidents, still that was a permissible finding, wasn't it? In light of the statutory presumption, it is possible to find is permissible for the district court to find, based on the evidence, that even if the presumption is not triggered, the district court still could find that there was constructive knowledge of ..
Yes, 2 points on that. The district court absolutely could make a finding of fact that a person had one prior, two priors, an invalid license, and then make the further finding that the innocent owner knew about those priors. What I'm arguing is that making that leap, whether it's saying presumed or whether it's saying found, finding constructive knowledge based solely on less than the statutorily defined amount of priors, that's what I'm arguing is impermissible. If that
impermissible is a matter
makes
of
sense.
Impermissible is a matter of law. In other words, the district court should have found that if the presumption is not triggered, then that leads to a conclusive determination that there was no constructive knowledge. That's your argument?
Absent evidence to the contrary, yes.
Well, because I mean,
it is the appellant's burden, but I mean, they can meet their burden, and then it's incumbent on the state to come forward with contradictory evidence, which they did via witness testimony for some of this.
Okay, thank you.
And again, Mr. Cole, you will have some time on rebuttal to address that. So turning now, is it Bueller? Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Bueller, go ahead.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the Yukon Denali in this case. That's the denominated party. In reality, it's the Polk County Sheriff's Office and the Polk County Attorney's Office that would be the respondent. I do want to thank you for allowing me to appear by Zoom today. You've saved me, in essence, what would have been about a 600-mile round trip to and from St. Paul to Crookston. And I just want to say at the outset here, I've been appearing in front of this court for almost 30 years now, but they have virtually all been criminal appeals. I think this is the first civil appeal that I've done. So if there's some fundamental flaw in the brief that was filed in this case, it rests solely with me and no one else. Here's my argument. I don't have a whole lot to add to the brief that I filed, and I would say that concessions made by appellant's counsel at the outset of his argument go a long way towards gutting his argument when it's all said and done.
Mr. Buehler, just to, in the interest of time, if maybe we could start where we sort of ended with Mr. Kohler. Assuming that there is no statutory presumption, and I think you conceded that much, if the burden is on Mr. Gilbertson to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he did not have actual constructive knowledge, and the district court has discredited all of his testimony, what is there then, aside from his testimony, that we could look to determine whether or not the evidence has crossed that higher threshold? Because it could be preponderance. It could be a preponderance. He could have proven by a preponderance, apart from his testimony, that he didn't have constructive knowledge, but that won't be enough under the statute. So what is it that we would have remaining to consider?
In this case, nothing, Your Honor. You're stuck with the record as it exists, and there is nothing else in this record. Now, I do disagree with the way counsel has represented the record in this case, in that talking about Ms. Rivard's one prior incident, that isn't the sole basis on which the district court found the defendant had actual or constructive knowledge. It was the way that this vehicle was purchased, trading in her other vehicle.
Now, let me stop you there, because I think you just said the way the district court found that he had active and constructive knowledge. But the statute, if I'm misreading it, I apologize. But as I understand it, the finding that would have been required is that he didn't prove he didn't have by clear and convincing evidence.
Correct.
Okay.
And I guess, and to follow up on that, Your Honor, I guess I would just point to the one unpublished opinion that I did cite with respect to this in Pruden, which was decided by this court in 2015, where I think the court sums up at least my position. But the statute does not limit forfeitures to cases in which the owner has this high degree of knowledge of the driver's offense. Quite the opposite. It requires a high degree of proof, clear and convincing, of the owner's lack of knowledge to avoid forfeiture that is presumed because of the offender's conduct. So the district court found that he actually had knowledge or constructive knowledge, didn't need to make that finding. It was the appellant's burden to prove that he didn't have it. And again, but I'm going back to the district court's finding that he did have knowledge or constructive knowledge, because if you look at the way this vehicle was purchased, trading in a prior vehicle is potentially subject to forfeiture. Ms. Rivard couldn't drive to get her vehicle. Mr. Gilbertson knew that, had to bring a third person along. Trades that vehicle in another vehicle, the Denali in this case, and as the district court pointed out, in that still is unexplained in this record, where this $24,000 plus that Mr. Gilbertson supposedly paid for this vehicle came from, because there's no evidence whatsoever in the record that he came up with that money other than his testimony, which was discredited by the district court. But then you have Ms. Rivard being involved in a traffic accident in Grand Forks, where she didn't have a valid driver's license, that Mr. Gilbertson conceded he was aware of. So he knew she had used this vehicle contrary to law. Now, counsel wants to argue that this is unfair to say that because he had that knowledge, we were entitled to forfeit the vehicle. But the statute gives him another out. And that is the alternative provision under Minnesota Statute 169A.63, subdivision 7, parentheses D. And that is, even if he has that knowledge, as long as he takes reasonable steps to prevent the use of the vehicle by the offender, he can avoid forfeiture. So there's no unfairness in this, that he knows of Ms. Rivard's past driving conduct, including DWI history, using the vehicle illegally while she's doesn't have a valid driver's license. He still has a way of avoiding forfeiture, but he didn't take advantage of it. And I think counsel has conceded that fact. He's working in the state of North Dakota. Him and Ms. Rivard live together in rural Polk County. If he's not around, she's obviously going to be able to drive that vehicle. There's only one key fob. That's what Mr. Gilbertson testified to. She, in fact, is driving that vehicle, commits another DWI offense. You know, the district court's findings of fact were pretty clear in this case, in that it found that initially when finding that Mr. Gilbertson was not the owner, talking about this certainly looked like it was a ruse to avoid forfeiture of a prior vehicle and a tactic to avoid possible forfeiture of the Denali in the future, given the past. And the district court also made it clear with regard to the actual constructive knowledge that the district court found the defendant, Mr. Gilbert, had actually enabled and encouraged the use and operation of the vehicle by an unlicensed remote driver, being Ms. Rivard. And with respect to the reasonable steps provision, the district court again found that if Mr. Gilbertson did everything in his power to ensure that Ms. Rivard could possess, use, or control the vehicle. This is a case in which, assuming for the sake of argument, that Mr. Gilbertson actually is a joint owner of this vehicle, he did nothing to meet his burden of proof. And that's really what it boils down to. There is a lack of evidence in the record, because this is not a case in which the state or the respondent bore any burden whatsoever. Once we established Ms. Rivard had the requisite conviction and was using a motor vehicle, the vehicle is presumed subject to forfeiture. It was incumbent then upon an appellant to establish by clear and convincing evidence. Now I got to be honest, clear and convincing evidence is a pretty high standard according to the Minnesota Supreme Court. The court indicated the evidence should be unequivocal, intrinsically probable and credible, and free from frailties. Well, that certainly is not Mr. Gilbertson's testimony in this case, and the district court clearly found against him. But as the party who bore the burden to prove his innocent owner defense by clear and convincing evidence, the only way he could succeed before this court is for him to prove that as a matter of law, he was an innocent owner. And he simply hasn't done it. Again, given the total history of Ms. Rivard and her driving while impaired and her actual use of this vehicle to violate the law, that clearly constitutes constructive knowledge at a minimum to Mr. Gilbertson that she would use this vehicle illegally if given the opportunity, and he gave her the opportunity by allowing her access to the one sole key to the vehicle when he was working in North Dakota. But I do want to comment on the fact that the district court never relied upon the presumption that because they're family or household members, that he was presumed to have this knowledge or constructive knowledge. And again, it wasn't the respondent's burden to prove that. The district court simply made the findings that he hadn't met his burden of proof, and in fact, it was the opposite. The district court's finding was that because Ms. Rivard and Mr. Gilbertson were living together, were fiancé, or were married, or excuse me, engaged to be married, had been living together for quite some time, and with regard to the purchase of this vehicle, the district court simply relied upon the common sense inference that two people in such a relationship involving the joint purchase of a motor vehicle, if that's what it was at best, it would be reasonable to infer that Mr. Gilbertson was aware of what Ms. Rivard would be doing with that vehicle. That's a common sense inference. And under the clearly erroneous standard.
And excuse me, may I just ask too? I think that the presumption operates that someone living with someone is presumed to know if is presumed to have knowledge of the if there is a certain number of priors. But here, didn't Mr. Gilbertson in fact testify? He knew she had priors, right? That's not really a question. You don't need to even infer it exactly. Did he not testify to it?
Correct. He knew of her prior DWI the forfeiture they were attempting to avoid when they traded in that vehicle. And then he also testified that he was aware she was driving this vehicle, the Denali, in Grand Forks when she was involved in a car accident. And he was aware of that, testified to. So he had knowledge that she had actually used this vehicle on a prior occasion, contrary to law. There's no inference that needs to be drawn from that. That's direct evidence by his own testimony that he was aware of that incident involving her. This was talking about the fact that counsel in his brief seemed to be attacking the district court's finding on this, but the district court never relied upon that presumption because it didn't need to in this case. Simply making the common sense inference that given the nature of these two and the testimony in the record, Mr. Gilbertson knew or had reason to know that Ms. Rivard would use the vehicle illegally, even though the respondent didn't bear the burden of proving that. It was Mr. Gilbertson's affirmative burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he didn't. I think that's what makes this case unique. This is not a case in which respondent had to prove something and Mr. Gilbertson was rebutting it. This was a burden that solely relied upon Mr. Gilbertson, and it was by clear and convincing evidence, higher than the preponderance of the evidence standard. And given this record, especially the district court's credibility determination against Mr. Gilbertson, which is more than supported by the record in this case, he simply has not even come close to meeting his burden as an innocent owner in this case. Now, I see I've got approximately 4 minutes to go. I don't have a whole lot to offer. Like I said, this case really boils down to the proper standard review, which is under the clearly erroneous standard. And as the Minnesota Supreme Court has made clear, that just because a district court could have found, as Mr. Gilbertson argues, doesn't mean that its finding to the contrary is clearly erroneous. District courts are fact finders in cases like this. They're entitled to make reasonable inferences based upon the fact for them. And those inferences are entitled to efforts by this court. And I just would go back to the rule of thumb that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that if there are two permissible views of the evidence and the finder of fact decides to choose one of them, that cannot be a clearly erroneous determination. And given the facts of this case, that is that Mr. Gilbertson's testimony lacked credibility, and that is really the only evidence in this record, is Mr. Gilbertson's testimony that lacked credibility. He did not call Ms. Rivard. The one witness who might have been able to corroborate some of his claims, he did not call her as a witness at the forfeiture hearing. And again, given the nature of their relationship, that is that they've lived together, were residing together at that time, and were engaged, I think the district court would have been entitled to also infer that the reason he didn't call her was the fact that she had nothing positive to add to his case, even though the district court did not make that actual finding in this case. But given the facts of this case, and including the extremely detailed and lengthy factual findings issued by Judge Remick, I believe that this court should be affirming the district court's order.
Mr. Beeler, did Mr. Gilbertson admit that he knew that Ms. Rivard's license was revoked, or was that that finding by the district court an inference based on circumstantial evidence?
If I recall correctly, when Mr. Gilbertson was cross-examined with regard to the prior incident involving the traffic accident over in North Dakota, he acknowledged at that point that he knew she didn't have a valid driver's license.
As of December of 2019, is that right?
That driving while impaired incident occurred on, I have to look here quick.
Well, I guess, what was the date of the accident?
I believe was in July 10th of 2020, and that would be, the district court makes some findings on that. It'd be finding number 3 at, I think it's page 6 or 7 of the district court's.
Okay, so it's approximately 7 months before the incident that is the underlying basis of the forfeiture.
Correct. Again, I go back to, the respondent did not need to prove that he was aware of this. It was respondent's affirmative burden to prove that he wasn't aware. That is, that he did not have actual or constructive knowledge that Ms. Rivard would use the vehicle illegally. The fact that she had in the past certainly supports the district court's finding as to why he did have such actual constructive knowledge in this case. And I see I've only got about a minute left. If there was nothing else,
If I can follow up, Mr. Beeler, apart from Mr. Gilbertson's testimony, there was testimony presented from the forfeiture officer, DK. What do you recall from that testimony about whether Mr. Gilbertson was informed regarding Mr. Bard's driver's license or driver's status at the time?
Now, I don't recall specifically, Your Honor, but I know one of the reasons that testimony was offered was because of Mr. Gilbertson's admission that he trades vehicles in to avoid forfeiture in the future. The inference being that he knew that they were going to be trading this vehicle in because Ms. Rivard, that vehicle was potentially subject to forfeiture. That was the reason they would trade that vehicle in immediately and buy a separate vehicle, was to potentially avoid forfeiture of that vehicle. I think that was the reason that evidence was introduced. All I know is that with regard to the driver's license, I don't know if that was specifically addressed at that point, but it was made clear that Ms. Rivard herself could not drive a motor vehicle. That's why a third party had to come with to be able to drive that motor vehicle away. And I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Mr. Kohler, rebuttal.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. One fact that came up during respondent's argument that I want to make sure we all understand. We keep talking about the presumption of constructive knowledge. The presumption, when it applies, is not that the innocent owner knew about the priors. The presumption is that the vehicle was going to be operated in a manner contrary to law. And it's a fine distinction.
But I do, Mr. Kohler, if I could, you know, you don't have a lot left. I wanted to have you respond to that same question. The testimony from DK is that she explained to both Gilbertson and Rivard at the time they came to get the Traverse in February 27, 2020, she explained to them that Rivard did not have a valid license and could not drive the Traverse. That's, I'm quoting from her testimony. So given the district court's credibility findings, coupled with the clear and convincing evidence standard and the fact that your client bears the burden of proof here, what is there that we could weigh against that testimony to show he didn't know that she did she was invalid, the status? And I understand there's a distinction you're making, but at least one step in the way is, does he know the status, or did he prove he didn't have constructive knowledge of her status? And it seems, given the testimony, that we are sort of left with that, unless I'm missing something that you'd like to emphasize or highlight for us. It seems that we have to assume he had knowledge that she was invalid.
Yes, and I don't think I've made the argument that he didn't know she was invalid. I mean, he did. Like, the argument is premised on the very few facts available to appellant, which I still think are enough to overturn the district court. The fact that he was not present when this incident happened, the fact that the negative fact that there can be no reliance on the presumption of constructive knowledge because there were not enough priors, which again, we're assuming he knew about her priors. We're assuming he knew that she was not valid. And I do actually think that admission was made in the transcript. All of that being said, I think he met the burden just by the fact that he wasn't present and that she didn't have the requisite amount of priors. He met the burden to show that he didn't have constructive knowledge that on that specific date, she was going to jump in the vehicle and she was going to drive. Not when he's one state over. And that's what it is it's, was she going to drive on that date? Like, even if it's a high probability, you don't presume that sort of constructive knowledge unless somebody had what the legislature decided. This amount of priors is when we can just go ahead and presume constructive knowledge. Then the burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that you didn't have constructive knowledge makes a lot more sense. Instead of having to prove a negative, regardless of the amount of priors that comes into play, that's a very difficult burden to address. But when you,
I appreciate your clarification. I certainly think that that's accurate about how the presumption operates. But I think that, you know, the presumption operated that you're domestic, and there are three, a domestic family member, and there are three, you're presumed to have constructive knowledge. But I take issue with the idea that if you know of priors and you admit to knowing of priors, that somehow the priors and your knowledge of them may not be considered because they're too few. I think they may be considered in a factual finding along with all the other evidence that we've discussed.
And if that's the situation, I disagree with that, but if that's what the court finds, then the district court did not abuse its discretion in taking those factors into account and presuming or finding that he did have constructive knowledge. So it hinges on the fact that there were limited but valid use spaces for the vehicle by Ms. Rivard. Mr. Gilbertson wasn't present, and there's no statutory presumption, which makes it very difficult to actually prove the innocent owner defense when there is the presumption of constructive knowledge. But absent that presumptive knowledge, the innocent owner defense is there to ensure the return of vehicles in situations where you're not actually aiding and abetting DWI. So for all of these reasons, we're asking the court to reverse the decision of the district court, order return of the vehicle to Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Kohler, just so I am clear on kind of what you're arguing the statute says, it's your argument that if you have one or two priors, the court has to disregard that fact. But if you have three, then there's a presumption. Is that what you're arguing the statute requires?
is worded a little more harshly than I would word, but I don't think it's relevant towards constructive knowledge. If somebody has one prior or if somebody has two priors, I think it becomes
What's so magic about three then that it would go from nothing to so relevant that we have this presumption? Where's that in the statute or case law, or is it just logic here?
That's the point, it's not magic. It's a democratically elected legislature drawing that line.
Okay. Thank you both for your arguments this morning and for the written briefs. We do appreciate the time that you've taken to prepare and present your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.